Welcome back to the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I'm Olivia, and this is Aaron, a man of the pod.
That's right, Olivia, and I've got some good news. Since we ended the last episode on a discussion of how we'll never really understand, like, what Old English sounded like and whether any modern English accents kind of preserve elements of Old English. But there's been good news, actually, in the previous 2 weeks, because since we recorded that podcast, new information has come to light that has allowed us to synthesize what Old English actually sounded like. And actually, we can play a little bit of that for you on the podcast now.
Wow, that's so exciting.
Okay, I'm pressing the play button now. Thunk.
Loam, praise of the prowess of people kings of Spearod Danes. In days long sped, we have heard what an honor the Aethlings won. Off skilled the sheepling from squandered foes, from many a tribe, the mead bench tore, awing the earls. Since erst he lay friendless a foundling, fate repaid him, for he waxed under welkin and wealth enthroned, till before him the folk from both far and near, who housed by the whale path, heard his mandate, gave him gifts, a good king be.
Wow, modern science really is impressive.
I love living in the year 2025. It's really good.
So, we're going to be continuing our discussion of how English changed during the Middle Ages with a look at English starting in the 11th century. So, last time we discussed how English went from being a humble dialect of West Germanic, mutually intelligible with all sorts of other West Germanic languages, to a force that would eventually come to dominate most of Great Britain, in particular modern-day England, and how it went from being a highly inflected Germanic language with a lot of grammatical gender and many differences to modern English, to gradually a more simplified, grammatically speaking, that is, version of itself, in particular because of influence from Norse invaders, who invaded quite a bit of England and eventually came to occupy quite a bit of its land in the east.
Yes, and I should say that by the time that we get to where we left the story off, which is, you know, the 9th, 10th century, we are still talking about what historians call Old English. Like, there's a lot of things still to come.
Oh, yes. We have talked about a few different loan words from Latin and Old Norse, but I think the biggest difference, I would say, and one that is seen, not uniformly, but I would say, at least to some extent, across England, is the slow loss of declension in particular. And you do see scribes, if you go through, like, Old English manuscripts leading up to the 11th century, you see scribes like gradually getting more and more confused by, like, you know, things like declension in different cases and like mixing up the accusative and the dative and the genitive. And you can only imagine that if you're seeing these things in written form, then they probably have existed in spoken form for a lot longer, because these are the scribes of the educated class, and literary language and written language is usually more conservative than spoken language. So we can only assume that, like, the farmers, the hillbillies, were probably, you know, throwing all that stuff to the wind ages ago.
So, as we mentioned in the last episode, by the 9th, 10th century, England is really starting to congeal as a solid sort of political unit. The various kingdoms are under the leadership of the House of Wessex, are subsumed into something that we can now recognizably call the Kingdom of England. And this is a kingdom that has its official language as English. Now, this is a very recognizable thing if you live in modern day England, where the official language of court administration is in fact English. But as we shall see, there's quite a detour that gets taken. So English is the language of the common people, but also the language of government. But Latin is the language of ecclesiarchy and of the church. And so you do have a lot of, in this period, you do have a lot of literature being written in English. A lot of it is, you know, preserved from older periods, from the oral traditions. A lot of it is pretty remarkably beautiful poetry that we've read many times before. I mean, Beowulf is just one example of a great canon, really, of Old English literature, which, if read in translation, it's pretty good. One of my favorite examples of Anglo-Saxon poetry, and yes, we're using the term Anglo-Saxon, talked about it last time,
yeah, I'm not getting into it. Yeah, let's not rehash this.
Yeah. One of my favorite examples of Anglo-Saxon poetry is The Seafarer, which is this kind of long epic that's told from the perspective of this old sailor, basically, about the life that he has lived and the things that he's seen, and it sort of progresses through the seasons of the year, from spring to summer to autumn to winter. And I'm going to read a little bit of it because I think this bit's very good. I like this bit. He's talking about autumn, but he's also talking about transience and death and the nature of life. The days are departed, all the glories of the kingdom of the earth. There are no kings or Caesars, nor gold givers such as there once were, when they performed among themselves so many magnificent deeds and lived in most lordly majesty. Fallen is all that troop. Joys are departed. Weaker ones now live and possess the world, gain use of it by their labor. Glory is bowed down. The nobility of earth ages and grows sere, as now every man across the world, old age comes to him. His face grows pale. The grey-haired one grieves, knows his friends of old times, the sons of princes, have been given up to the earth.
So as you can tell, at that point, Old English sounded a lot like modern English.
So that was in translation, obviously. I should have led with that. So I'm just using this as a little flavor of to make the point that English is very much a literary language at this point. Yes. These are not a bunch of what I think is often imagined when we think of early medieval Germanic peoples, a bunch of smelly mud men running around and hitting each other with clubs and wearing furs.
No, there's a very complex literary tradition. As I've said before, there are very well-defined poetic forms, and there is a standardized dialect, a standardized literary dialect of Old English, which is Late West Saxon. So this is the latest, most grammatically simple, I would say, form of the West Saxon dialect, which is local to the area of Wessex, which is where the dominant kingdom is. But the other dialects still persist.
Mm-hmm. So, to cut an incredibly long and complicated story short, because this is not an episode about 11th century English politics, that will come later. This is an episode about the English language. In 1066, the King of England, Edward the Confessor, dies, and there is a succession crisis. There are three claimants, Harold Godwinson, Harald Hardrada, the King of Norway, and William, the Duke of Normandy. Who were the Normans? To keep it short, they're a bunch of Vikings who turned French.
Weird cousins. There are weird cousins.
They really are. Like, they are essentially, the phrase that I think of when I think of the Normans is a bunch of crypto-Viking pirates. Like, that's who they are. And anyway, again, to take a very, very complicated story, which we will get to in due course, in a very simplified way, after a series of battles, William of Normandy conquers England, and basically the entire direction of English history changes completely. In ways that are, like, you can't even begin to cover in a single episode of a podcast. But for our story, there are, I think, a couple of things to draw out that are very, very important. So first of all, William the First and his sort of Norman entourage do essentially replace the old Anglo-Saxon nobility. And in the course of that, the language of the court and the language of royal administration changes. So English is no longer the language of power. Now the language of power is French. And this speaks to a wider orientation that we will see throughout the 11th and 12th centuries, which is the English elite become this kind of weird offshoot of the French cultural sphere. They are French, but they are also Francophile. And so French becomes not just the language of politics, but also the prestige language. Oh, and by the way, at a more or less the same time, a little chunk of Northumbria gets just chopped off by Scotland and disappears. We'll come back to that chunk, because it will become important later.
They wanted North Berwick so badly.
The fact that the Anglo-Scottish border is the Tweed and not the Forth is incredibly important, and it happens at this point. It will have profound consequences for Scotland. But again, we'll get to Scotland in a bit.
Yep.
So, what happens to English as a language as a result of those changes?
I mean, I think the most concise answer you could give is nothing, in that it stops being used for basically everything it was being used before. So, it basically stops being used for record keeping, for legal purposes, for any official purposes. It's no longer taught in school. It loses all prestige, and this is due to elite replacement. So in this case, actually, we have a very good idea of how England was taken over by the Normans. They wrote it all down, and they made a lot of embroidery about it. They made a nice piece of embroidery explaining how they put horses in boats. And then
men on those horses.
Yeah, and then they just took all of the English land and they gave it to the Normans. And they took a lot of English assets and they gave them to the Normans. And there's, yeah, again, pretty clear record keeping that shows exactly how this happened. And although they didn't necessarily try to suppress use of the English language, this was the start of centuries and centuries of the status of English in England as being second class to French, and of French being a prestige language with much more social clout compared to English. And this is also the start of something that everyone in England will be glad to hear about, and that is the dominance of one particular region of England, everyone's favorite place. What's the most geographically important area of England after the conquest? It's bigger than the Small Smoke.
London.
London town. Yeah. So remember all of those dialects we talked about, and how the West Saxon dialect was spoken, well, basically along the south coast and in the west. The Mercian dialect was right in the middle. And so the Mercian dialect of English was what was spoken in and around London. And William the Conqueror saw London and he thought, yes, please, I'll put my capital right there. Mm-hmm. Make this a nice, important city. It's already a nice, important city.
Well, it
but
wasn't.
I'll put my big tower there.
It was. So London, this is a tangent, but London in the Anglo-Saxon period, it's an important place in the sense that it's an important trading center, but it's not what it was in either the Roman period or the Norman period, which is a seat of political power.
Yes,
like the Anglo-Saxons do repopulate London eventually, and they do fix some of the walls, but like they don't really care about London.
Yeah, exactly. But all of a sudden, for William, easy routes to the continent by sea became really important, and London is just a very strategically well-situated city. That's why the Romans founded it and built their big Roman walls around it.
Although they always preferred Colchester anyway.
Ah, well.
The great metropolis.
But yeah, London was a pretty wealthy place, and William the Conqueror, although he, as he was now known at this point, I think he had finally cast off his previous moniker, which was William the Bastard. Although I think a lot of people still regarded him as a bastard, and he wasn't necessarily fair to all of his subjects, and he did build a
gigantic... He did a bit of a genocide.
Yeah, Yeah, I mean, I wouldn't. Let's not debate about genocide.
I mean, he certainly unleashed terrifying death upon quite a few people.
Yeah. But, you know, he wanted to plan for the long term. Like, he knew that he had to keep things mostly intact.
Just, yeah, that's true. He preserved a load of Anglo-Saxon institutions, but it's still important to note that the Norman conquest, we will litigate, again, there are episodes coming about that where we will litigate all of this properly, but, like, it was not a nice time.
Yeah, but my point is, I guess, that, like, English-speaking still was very much around.
And yes, the
majority
of
people in England were still English speakers. And at this point, they also were, to a great extent, speakers of the Mercian dialect. So even before the conquest, this was the most geographically widespread and most well represented among the population. And so the dominance of this Mercian dialect among all the other English dialects, I think the importance of that or the influence of that is sometimes eclipsed by what we're about to discuss after this, which is the massive influence of French.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it's also worth pointing out that the Mercian dialect also contributed to what we now think of as modern English. So there are just a few little things that made the Anglian dialects, which would be, I think, Mercian and Kentish, which were quite similar to each other, that made those distinctive. So we have a lot of diphthongs, so vowel combinations get shortened in this dialect. So, for instance, whereas if you cut something in two and you take one of those parts, West Saxon, that would be a half, but in Mercian, that would be just a half. And you see that pattern with things like coal, or the word for coals in West Saxon, it would have been kaled. And in Anglian, that was sort of shortened and flattened to just called. So, yeah.
So not everything could be blamed on the French.
Exactly. And as well with the I sound that we get in, for instance, words like milk and sick and pig. In a lot of other dialects and earlier in Old English, those would have been things like milk and silk. And so on. And so, yeah, in general, we see a lot of patterns in the Mercian dialect of this sort of shortening of words and of diphthongs. And that's definitely represented in later versions of English. And there's also, I think, a general trend away from emphasis on the last syllable in words. So whereas before, if you had something like, I don't know, hate, it would have been pronounced something like hate or hate-a.
So what you're saying is that back then people would have spoken like Matt Berry.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. And you can see
you are the most devious bastard in
New York City.
Old York City.
Yeah, exactly. Except then it would have been, you know, Old York. But, you know, you would have had patterns throughout this Anglo-Saxon period where, yeah, you would have things like hata, and then it would have gone to hata, and then hate, or something like that. So, yeah, again, a lot of patterns that distinguish English from other Germanic languages.
So this is why we don't say ye oldie anymore.
Exactly. Although, of course, the later on great vowel shift at the end of the Middle Ages, beginning then, would have also changed words very dramatically.
Okay, now, this is all very interesting, but I'm sure what I think I know what people came here for, which is vocab. They want to hear about different kinds of vocabulary. So we get a lot of loan words that flood into English at this point. A lot of the most significant words inherited from French in English relate to government, like the word government.
Ah.
Yeah, gouvernement.
Gouvernement.
So we also have...
Monsieur le gouvernement.
Oui, exactement. So we also have conseil for council. We have estat for state and estate. We have corps for court. And we have justice for...
Justice.
Yes.
Yes, so they take out the old English system of trials by things like oaths, and they replace
trial by mate.
Exactly. Yeah, trial by bestie. And they replace it with all these newfangled courts that have things like trial by talking to the judge, trial by bailiff. And so a lot of our modern legal diction comes either from French or from Latin, often via French, and dates back to that period. One of my favorite examples of this is the existence of the legal doublet. So have you ever wondered why, instead of getting charged with, you know, just assault, you can get charged with assault and battery, breaking and entering, cease and desist? Like, don't cease and desist mean the same thing? For all intents and purposes, isn't an intent the same thing as a purpose? And so null and void, like, what's up with that? And so one of the reasons why we have a lot of these extremely complicated legal terms is because they date back to a time when all of the courts were in French, but not everyone spoke French. And so crimes would often be given two names. One would be a French one and one would be an English one. And so that is why we have a lot of those fun and funky terms.
Oh, and by the way, actually, speaking of law and courts, we also get, it's a bit of a later introduction, but it's very much in this Norman period, the word parliament, which comes from parlement, which means, you know, speak, place to speak, basically, which is a French word that originally just had, until quite late in France, referred to a type of court. But of course, in English, came to mean the national legislature. But it's not just politics terms that English absorbs. So we also get words relating to warfare. So words like army, mail, as in chainmail, regiment, general, or sergeant are all Anglo-Norman.
Melee,
absolutely. Cavalry. But we also have words in the art world, like the word art.
Yes.
And the word color. And ornament. And in the world of education, we also get the words lesson and pupil from French. Now, of course, it's also important to note that many of the words that entered English via Norman French were themselves words that were loan words from elsewhere. So the word baron, for example, which is a very traditionally French aristocratic title.
Baron.
It comes from Old High German.
Oh, there yeah. you go.
So, as Olivia's been mentioning, as French sort of assumed a new sort of role as the language of the elite and the language, very much the language of public life, you have this very strange situation where, and there's no two ways about this, it has too many synonyms. There are two. And anybody who has learned English as a second language, I'm sure, has picked up on this. There are too many things that either mean that where two words mean exactly the same thing, or they mean something incredibly subtly different from one another.
Yes.
This whole situation was summed up very, very articulately by one of the great English language learners, the Argentinian author Borges. And he has a fantastic quote about English that I just love. I love it to death. I think it's incredible. It changed the way that I think about the language completely. And I want you to play along with me in this dialogue that he's having with the interviewer.
Oh, yes. Wait, let me get the notes up.
I find English a far finer language than Spanish.
Why?
William F. Buckley, everyone. Thank you.
Cider.
That's all staying in.
I'm William F. Buckley.
Well, many reasons. Firstly, English is both a Germanic and a Latin language. Those two registers. For any idea you take, you have two words. Those words will not mean exactly the same. For example, if I say regal, that is not exactly the same thing as saying kingly. Or I say fraternal, that is not the same as saying brotherly, or dark and obscure. Those words are different. It would make all the difference, speaking, for example, of the Holy Spirit, it would make all the difference in the world if in a poem I wrote about the Holy Spirit, or I wrote the Holy Ghost, since ghost is a fine, dark Saxon word, but spirit is a light Latin word. So another thing that I wanted to pick up on from, you know, from the previous episode is this point about English becoming more... When English loses all of its cases, losing things like grammatical gender, losing inflections, it becomes a lot more flexible in the kinds of sentences that you can construct. And Borges, he has another quote about English that I think is very, very interesting and is not really relevant to the point about developing it, but I think he's a very smart man and you'd all be better for hearing it. So he says, and then you have in English, you can do almost anything with verbs and prepositions. For example, to laugh off, to dream away. Those things can't be said in Spanish. To live down something, to live up to something. You can't say those things in Spanish. They can't be said. Or really any Romance language. The only time any speaker of a Romance language has ever said anything positive about English. Ever. It's never happened since. And to take this point about English having these, what they call synonymic pairs, these words that, again, they fit together very, very well, and they either mean the same thing or they mean almost the same thing, but there's this very slight different register. To take that a step further, I'd like to take us back to a point that we've talked about before on the show a couple of times, which is the fact that English has all these different words for meat that are kind of abstracted away from the actual animals themselves. So lots of people have picked up on this, and lots of people have commented on the fact that the words for the animals themselves are of Germanic language. So, for example, cow is of Old English derivation, calf is of Old Norse derivation, but the words for the meats themselves are generally French. So, you know, bouffe, porc, and so on. And I think it's interesting, isn't it, that the words that relate to animal husbandry and the work of raising animals are of Old Germanic extraction, but the words that relate to consumption and the prestigious act of consuming great meats are French. Now, this isn't to say, there's a caveat here, because people have called us out on this before. This isn't to say that the fact that those different words exist is because of this linguistic divide, right? Because we've talked before about how where it comes from is actually it comes from, you know, the very particular hunting culture that loved just inventing different words for different things and frippery like that. But I do think it's telling that there is this very clear pattern of association in the etymologies of the words, even if the fact that they are different is not in and of itself because of that.
Yeah, I also think it's important to point out that, like, by and large, although elites can originate words, there has to be a certain prestige that encourages the common people to use those words in order for those words to take hold.
So, oh, absolutely.
For instance, saying beef for the meat of a cow, just the fact that the nobles were saying beef and referring to their cow meat as beef is not enough to make that take over as the dominant word. It has to be adopted by the common people as well. But I think it's certainly the case that food is a symbol of social status in much the way that language is, and it's often something that goes hand in hand with these same cultures of prestige. I mean, I think that, you know, whereas, for instance, animal husbandry sits pretty firmly in the category of something that is done by lower class people, there isn't really a posh versus a working class way to raise a cow.
No.
Whereas, you know, you can, I think, elucidate class dynamics through food and the way that food is prepared and discussed and eaten much more easily.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's that puts a very fine point on it, I think. There is an example of English being used for official communication that people during the Norman period, that people will get mad at me if I don't mention, which is to say that after King John signs the Magna Carta in 1258, there is a proclamation that goes around to all of the king's subjects in to announce the basically of the political change. And what's important about this proclamation is that it's written, yes, in Latin and in French, but it is also written in English. And what is further interesting is that it is written in a form of English that we know is anachronistic for the time. So it is written basically in a style of English that feels like from an older time. There are lots of tells for this. So, for example, they in the English version of the letters, they refer to the king's advisors as redesmen and not counselors, which would be the appropriate French loan word. And also, the witnesses, the lords who were witness to it, were referred to as earls and not counts. Again, earl is an Anglo-Saxon word, count is a French word. And of course, at the start of the letter, the phrase "through God's fultum," which means "through God's grace or help," is written instead of something that's based on the French expression "par la grâce de Dieu," which would be more appropriate and more conventional at the time, which suggests two things. Number one, this is being aimed at the common man, which is fascinating for a royal declaration of this period. And second of all, it tells us that, yes, the version of English being spoken by the common man was probably more conservative and more, quote-unquote, Anglo-Saxon than even the versions of English that we do see in writing from this period.
Yeah, and so over the subsequent couple of centuries after the Norman invasion, and in particular before English really resurfaced as a literary language, French began to gain a foothold amongst even the working class and middle class members of English society.
What's aspirational?
Yes, exactly. Everyone wanted to be French. And, you know, you can imagine going down the pub with your mates, your English mates, with, you know, Alfred and, Carl, and, you know, being the first of your friends to ask for like some beef instead of some cow, and they all start laughing at you. But then like within the year, they're all saying it too.
Many such cases.
Many such cases. They're saying it's happening more and more.
No!
In Colchester. But what's interesting is that a lot of these words, these new French-derived and Latin-derived words, survived into modern-day English alongside their Germanic siblings.
Yeah, and I think that's maybe the thing that makes the Norman French cultural invasion sort of distinct from the Norse influence, is a lot of the Norse words that we've got, like window, for example, are words that just fully replaced what was there before.
Yes.
Whereas in the French, the French influence, it's a coexistence.
Yes.
And you do have what Borges calls these two registers.
Yeah, I mean, there was some replacement, of course.
Oh, of course,
yeah. I just
need
to say that to cover my ass.
It's all relative.
You have a lot of pairings where the Germanic word sounds much more simple and much more humble than its Romance equivalent. So, for instance, if you just take like, you know, many versus multiple or numerous, many being the English and multiple being the Romance derived word, or if you have, for instance, we think house versus domicile, or like fire versus inferno or conflagration, then often, yeah, you do have, and these are not, I should say, all words that can be linked back to the Norman invasion. A lot of these are later inventions, but I'm just
trying to give. But there is a general trend here.
An idea of the general trend. And yeah, what I think is also interesting is that in modern English, you almost have the opposite, where some of these words have become, these Romance words have become so well integrated into English that then the Germanic root words begin to sound archaic and arcane, like how he said ghost is almost a kind of darker, more sort of primeval sounding word than spirit.
Yes, there is something. I'm glad you picked up on this as well, because this is something I think about a lot, is that, like, when, for example, when I was writing all the way back in October, when I was writing an intro for the Vikings episode, I very consciously chose only words that were of Germanic origin.
Nice.
I very consciously was like, I'm not going to include anything that is romance derived. And what I found by that exercise was that you get words, that the words that are Germanic tend in English, other than the really basic ones, tend to be things that are quite tactile, things that are quite kind of, they feel kind of earthy and direct. And also, yes, there is this kind of darkness to some of them as well. Whereas Latin and French words, they can feel intellectual, abstracted, and almost kind of haughty.
Yeah.
Now, that's a very literary way of putting it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's,
it's an oversimplification.
We should say that is how it would be interpreted by an average English speaker, you know. Like, that is not an innate quality, of course,
no.
of the words.
No. This is all about, I'm talking purely about, because you were talking about cultural context. And so I'm talking about cultural context as
yes.
well.
Yes. But may I give a couple examples?
Please.
I mean, I think, for instance, you said, what was it, like, royal versus kingly or
regal
something.
Regal versus kingly, yeah.
Yeah, regal. And that, you know, the L-Y ending is a great example, I think, because that's a really common one in English. And some examples of it sound completely normal, like daily or nightly. But then, yeah, there are other versions, I would say, where... it almost begins to perhaps come across to an English speaker as sounding a bit archaic almost. I think even if you take, like, say, fatal versus, like, deadly, deadly somehow sounds much more visceral. I think that's a really good example of that. Or, for instance, like, you know, project versus forecast or foretell. You know, having that, like, for prefix.
Yeah.
For say.
For always has this air of sort of mysticism about it.
Yeah, exactly.
Foreboding.
Exactly, yeah.
And it's possible to, like, overstate how important this trend is. And I think that Borges in particular, it's important to remember his kind of context and his very particular interests in language, which, I mean, you could fill an entire book describing what Borges thinks about language.
Yeah.
And if you want an introduction to what he thinks about language, go read the short story Tlon Ukbar Orbis Tertius, which is probably one of the most viscerally frightening short stories I've ever read, and is purely about the use of language and word choice. Good fucking book, man. Anyway, moving on. So, checking in place names. Let's talk very quickly about place names. So how many Norman or French place names are there in Britain?
Two.
What are they?
Thedon Boys.
Yes!
And Pont Quotidien.
I thought you were going to say Weston-super-Mare.
No.
Yeah,
I thought that one's Latin.
Oh, yeah, it is. Shit. Anyway, the Normans didn't really rename a lot of places. They did, however, like, slightly change names, but they didn't really understand or like. So, for example, Nottingham, before the Norman conquest, used to be called... You'll never get this in a million years.
Okay.
Snottingham.
Yes! No, I did know that! I did know that! My brother told me that!
Snottingham Forest. The Sheriff of Snottingham.
Yes.
Snottingham Trams. these all could have been yours, were it not for those French pirates. So I'm going to go back to my pin board and take out one of the pins that I put in things earlier in one of these episodes and say, what is happening in Scotland? Because, of course, England is not the only country where English is spoken. When Scotland annexed the territory of the northern, basically the northern chunk of Northumbria, in the 11th century, it got something that it didn't have before, which is a bunch of English speakers. Scotland in the high Middle Ages and the early Middle Ages, to be honest, was an incredibly linguistically diverse country, much more linguistically diverse even than England, which I think we've already established is incredibly diverse. I mean, in the early Middle Ages, you basically had, oversimplifying things a lot, you kind of could divide the country four ways. In the northwest, you had Irish-speaking Scots. Yes, I'm going to call it Irish because that's what it was at the time. Then in the northeast, you had Picts who spoke. we'll get there one day. Then, of course, in the southeast, you had English speakers, and in the southwest, you had Strathclyde, a territory full of people who still spoke a version of Brittonic, and so Scotland's a mess. Basically, it's an absolute, like, linguistically, it's a nightmare. The language of the elite in Scotland is Irish, because Scotland is basically just a renamed, rebranded version of the Kingdom of Alba, which was an Irish-speaking kingdom. And what then happens to these English people living in the southeast of Scotland, what is now Edinburgh, the Lothians, and the Scottish borders, when they are suddenly introduced to all these different languages of different extractions from all over the British Isles, right? Olivia, what do you think happens to the way that they talk?
I think it stays exactly the same.
Correct. Sweet fuck all happens to it. I know. I know you were expecting that to be her being flip, but no, it's literally true. So this is not, by the way, Olivia and I have literally argued about whether or not Scots is a language. I think it is. So don't get mad at me for this next thing that I'm going to say. Throughout the Middle Ages, there is no evidence that the English spoken in Scotland was in anything other than the Northumbrian dialect of English, right? That is important context for what I'm about to talk about. It picks up a lot of individual sort of loan words from Gaelic, but really probably not enough to fundamentally change it or make it. It would just be like, again, a weird dialect, basically. There is an extent to which, though, that the Scottish version of Northumbrian English does stay a little bit more conservative than the English that's spoken down in England. So, for example, like we've talked, what's the example you have for? Oh yeah, for example, greet is preserved as it is in some dialects of Northern English. With a meaning that it doesn't have in southern versions of English. Now, you're probably saying to yourself, but Aaron, Scotland was never conquered by the Normans. If the Normans were so hugely influential in the direction of Middle English over the Middle Ages, and they never conquered Scotland, why did the version of English spoken in Scotland change in parallel to what was happening in English?
Because they was fucking.
Well, no, because they was French as well.
Because they was fucking. They were all part of the same incestuous group of, you know, trans-channel, like, nobility, you know?
Well, and also, well, no, exactly, that's my point, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Yeah, yeah, because what happens in the 11th century... Sorry, what happens in the 12th century is that King David I of Scotland is a tremendous Francophile. He loves France. He loves the French language. And so he eventually invites a bunch of Norman and Flemish aristocrats over to Scotland to take over a bunch of land and become the new sort of landed gentry. And so... And in Scotland as well, the language of power, the language of the elite, becomes French as well.
Yeah, like Robert the Bruce was out there speaking French.
Oh, yeah.
William Wallace was out there speaking French.
I don't know. I don't actually know.
He did speak French.
The Bruce family definitely are. David I also does another important thing for the development of English in Scotland, which is he does some very important political reforms and economic reforms, which is to say that he sets up basically the first towns that have ever existed in Scotland. Basically, like, there was a great craze that swept through Europe at around this time for creating boroughs or free cities or whatever you want to call them. Basically, like, special economic zones where you didn't get taxed quite the same way. And it was a way to encourage trade and to encourage economic development. Again, very surprisingly recognizable rationale to modern day Freeport style economics. And what that meant was that up to this point, the English speakers in Scotland had been concentrated in this corner in the southeast. But with the establishment of these new towns all over the country, a lot of them are in the south east, but a lot of them are also up along the east coast and in the west of the country. So you get a lot of internal migration and also migration to Scotland from England. And so English starts to spread, and English becomes very much one of the main languages of the country, the other of which is Gaelic, which gradually sort of muscles out Pictish and Brittonic over the course of the High Middle Ages. And so by the end of the Middle Ages, you have the sort of cliched, conventional vision of Scottish languages, where the Highlands, the North and the West, are Gaelic-speaking overwhelmingly, but in the Lowlands and in the Northeast, English is the, no pun intended, lingua franca. But again, this is still very much a version of English that would have been recognizable and intelligible to people from the north of England. It's very different to, as we were discussing before the podcast, it's very different to now when you go over the border and there is this instant violent accent shift.
Yeah.
Like, I was shocked when it happened, and I shouldn't have been because I know better, but I was still shocked.
Yep.
Because, you know, as a cosmopolitan Scottish person, you don't want to assume that England is as different from Scotland as it actually is. You always want to think that it's all overblown, but it is genuinely a different place. Now, the first real direct references to a Scottish language, as in, you know, what we would now call Scots, come at the end of the 15th century, when there has been a radical and profound reshaping of the geopolitics of this region that also have an impact on the status of English in England. And that is our old friend, the Hundred Years' War.
Yeah, so remember how I said that French was slowly gaining more and more of a foothold through its prestige, its, you know, beautiful phonology, just the sheer elegance.
Of une the, oof.
I mean, sorry. And of course, French was in some ways being influenced by English as well. But unfortunately, French's honeymoon in England was not to last. They had a good run, but it couldn't go on forever. And really, who do we have to blame for that? I would say the French.
Well, okay, explain yourself.
Bastards. Well, you just said yes in French, so I don't have to. Wah.
Wah.
No, I mean, I'm mostly joking about that.
Well, listen, it all comes down to, as I said, politics, or, as Pitbull calls it, politics.
Wait, you said politics.
Keep that in.
I'm leaving that. That makes it sound like you are Pitbull. Amazing.
I'm so tired.
Okay, let's power through. Let's power through. We'll wrap it up soon.
Politics, or as Pitbull calls it.
Politics. Yeah, so over the course of the following centuries, in the Middle Ages leading up to the late 14th, sort of 15th century-ish, English was still in use widely, and it was still continuing to change and develop. For the most part, French didn't have much of an impact on its grammar, so the grammar is still pretty distinct mm-hmm. from French. We see French influence in a few things.
Well, I'd say that the biggest thing is probably that it did probably contribute to the end of English having grammatical gender. Just in a sort of diffuse sense. Like, this is very much the period in which you start to see dialects of English just straight up lose it.
Yeah, definitely, definitely.
But it doesn't also, really. It does, but English doesn't start adopting French morphology and French sentence structure.
Yeah, I mean morphology. Yeah, because that's just like spelling, right? But yeah, syntax definitely not. So yeah, I mean you see it in a few things like titles, like Prince Regent. You know, that's French, not Regent Prince. The specific word ordering is French, but yeah, I would say it's pretty minimal. But the vocabulary.
Attorney General.
The vocabulary, absolutely, and. One of the big lasting legacies of, I think, French and the Romance languages on English as well, is extends even beyond the Middle Ages, is a people's tendency to change English spellings to look more French. So if you take the word island, for instance, originally spelled in Middle English, I-L-A-N-D, S was added in to kind of make it more resemble the French île. Or words like scissors, the SC, rather than just S-I-S-S-O-R-S, which would be the original. Or debt used to just be spelled D-E-T, but the B was added to kind of align it with, like, the Latin debitum.
It's just, this really is, I mean, this story, it's an amazing story, but it really is a story of a language getting stupider and more complex at the same time.
Yeah, yeah, because...
And arbitrary.
Yeah, because the people that speak it just hate it. They hate it so
badly.
Can
I pretend it's French if I add some random consonants? No.
Exactly. But over the course of the High Middle Ages, slowly English identity begins to rebound. And I won't get into all the reasons for that. Actually, we have very few examples of English literature from before the late Middle Ages and the era of Chaucer. And the examples that we do have, I think, help kind of elucidate how English went from this Old English, very Germanic inflected language to Middle English, which is still pretty hard to understand, but much, much more similar to modern English than to Old English. So we do have a few transitional texts, but it's not really until the 14th century with the arrival on the scene of one literary man named Geoffrey Chaucer, that we start to see English being reintroduced as a language of arts and culture to be consumed by the upper class.
Yeah, so Chaucer is interesting because one of the things that you kind of miss when you approach him, as a lot of people do in school, as this kind of, you know, this titanic character of you know, the canon of English literature, is that he's very populist.
Yes.
Like this, like again, like half of the Canterbury Tale, half of the Canterbury Tales is like, hey, here's a type of guy that you know and we can all laugh at. And the other half is, look at my bum.
Yep.
But
or women, huh?
Hey, you like one of them. And also relatable, Homest Among Us. But that being said, you really cannot overstate how incredibly important it is that at this point you have people just writing stuff like that in English again.
Yes.
The idea of English as a literary language, and that also being, again, in the context of the deteriorating relationship between England and France, that being, I think, I suspect, a downstream of politics to some degree, the idea that English could be reclaimed and it could be made into a sort of great literary language and that it had cultural cachet and cultural capital. It's a huge development.
Yes.
Because, all the original elites who spoke English got murdered.
Yeah.
Very deliberately, for a reason. And here's, and here are people like Chaucer now coming out of the woodwork and writing, you know, writing literature.
Absolutely, and writing literature for, again, the courts.
Yes.
For the nobility. And contemporary responses to Chaucer were pretty positive in his day. He was revered as the greatest poet ever in English, which they probably weren't super aware of.
They didn't know about the Seafarer.
But yeah, they didn't know about Beowulf. They didn't know about the Seafarer. They didn't know about the Nibelungen Lied. So we can forgive them that. And they absolutely loved, you know, the fart jokes. And there's not that many of those in Beowulf. So what can you really say? But yeah, and it he immediately sparked a wave of English language poetry, and I think there's very few times in history when you can so clearly link one man or one person to an immediate effect. And the fact that I think this was his Canterbury Tales and a lot of his important works were published at the height of the Hundred Years' War, when there was this ongoing conflict between England and France. I think that it's not necessarily a coincidence that people had this positive reaction to English poetry, which could easily be seen implicitly as a celebration of Englishness and English identity. And especially having grown up with the idea that French was the poetic language and the official language and the courtly language, and growing up with French notions of chivalry and romance that had been imported basically whole cloth from the continent, I think that this was a really positive sort of affirmation of their culture for English people.
And I think that it really does prefigure. You're right, there's not many cases of somebody being as central as Chaucer to the kind of the revitalization of a language, especially a living language that is kind of, you know, the language of the common man.
Yeah.
A peasant language. But there are lots and lots and lots of examples in modern European history, especially in the Romantic era, and then in the era of 19th century revolutions and the rise of nationalism. There are countless examples of these quote-unquote peasant languages being raised up by, you know, bluntly activist academics and poets, and being given very self-consciously trying to give them their kind of day in the sun. I'll give you a couple of random examples off the top of my head. Romanian. Romanian was dirt language, basically. I'm sorry, Romanian people, but like you Romanians already know this, so they don't have to get mad at me. When Transylvania in particular was controlled by the Kingdom of Hungary, Hungarian was the prestige language. And Romanian was suppressed. And the idea that you would write in Romanian was absurd. Like, what could you possibly say in Romanian? Same exact thing happens with Maltese, for example. Maltese, until the 20th century, Maltese was this weird kind of, like, really fucked up sounding, like, dialect of, like, Arabic that had all this Italian stuff in it that was spoken basically by fishermen and farmers. And the idea that you would write literature in Maltese was ridiculous. Like, and it's still contentious to this day that Maltese was sort of given this official status and risen up to the status of a literary language. And so I think that it's part of a very clear tendency of language, the question of what is a language and what is a language worth writing great works of art in, is always going to be inseparable from politics. Coming back again to our argument about is Scots a language, is fundamentally also not just a question of linguistics, it's also a question of politics.
Yeah.
How culturally separate is Scotland from England? How different are they really? And once you start asking that, if you have a nationalist kind of brain wiring, which is pretty much everybody on earth has at this point, then you start to ask, how politically separate should they be? You're not necessarily thinking that when you are having the argument, but that's why it's emotive.
Again, one point I really want to drive home is the stigma against speaking English in England for most of the Middle Ages, if you're a member of the nobility. I mean, Edward IV, the 15th century English king, was, I believe, the first English king since the Norman Conquest to marry an English woman.
Scandalous.
It was incredibly scandalous. It was incredibly dramatic, and it was really only a couple generations before him, I think, that English kings even began to speak English. I mean, the extent to which English would have been completely absent from court and official life, in particular before the 15th century, it really cannot be overstated. And of course, I think it would have crept in some ways, especially because of the tensions between the English and the French people. But again, I think it is, yeah, worth pointing out that it's pretty impressive that the process and the advancement of this prestige French culture and language and its slow, you know, eclipsing of the English language was reversed by external political and social factors to such an extent that, you know, 100 or so years, 150 years after Scandal of Scandals, the king married an English woman, suddenly there were English kings who were, you know, born in England, who came of British, you know, from British roots, and who had their roots on the island, who didn't make necessarily these sort of elaborate claims to French ancestry.
Yeah. Well, and there, of course, the wonderful crippling irony of that being that where is it that the first kind of quote-unquote British kings come from in the 15th century?
They come from Wales, but, yes. You know, they're not talking about that.
And also, they're not that Welsh.
Yeah.
I think that it's really interesting, and it gets so underappreciated, I think, when we're used to English being an elite language, being a language that people across the world study as an aspirational thing. We're so used to it that we don't think how radical it is, really, that a couple generations after that, Shakespeare is writing plays specifically to be performed to Elizabeth I and James I that are in English. And they are also in modern English, because it is in Shakespeare's time when we arrive at something that no longer needs to be translated into modern English.
Yeah, you remember saying to your teacher in ninth grade, like, oh, I can't read all this old English in Shakespeare.
You're like, you have no fucking idea how good you have it, idiot. You lazy. Well, no, I mean, Shakespeare is hard to approach, even on the page, because it's flowery and it's poetic. But there's actually, if you have a solid vocabulary in modern English, there's very little in Shakespeare that has to be translated. Like, very, very little. Whereas, again, read a bit of Shakespeare and then read a bit of Chaucer, and you tell me which one is easier.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Shakespeare is in many ways not a great example of 16th century English, because it is a bit overwrought, I think, to a modern audience.
Yes.
I mean, it's like if you played The Thick of It to a, you know, 16th century audience,
mm-hmm.
and they had to listen to Peter Capaldi being like, you know, I'm going to shove your cell phone so far up your ass you'll be able to call your mum with your kidneys or whatever.
Yeah. Like, why are you talking about Daleks? What's a Dalek?
Exactly.
And then, of course, there's the not inconsiderable fact that Shakespeare doesn't prefigure modern English. He kind of invents it in a way. Like, modern English is based self-consciously on Shakespeare.
Oh, people, it's based off of the same stand. Yeah.
Yeah. People ape. I'm not saying that, like, Shakespeare literally invented it, like he sat down and invented it, but, like, people are aping Shakespeare and copying him for generations and generations to come, because he's that influential and he's that prestigious. That's right. Prestige. This was all of the prestige. So what did you learn, Olivia?
These days, if you say you're English,
you don't get thrown in jail.
God bless.
But 'twas not always so.
I just think the English language is a colorful and beautiful thing. I love it. You know, it's not, as many people claim, it's not the language with the largest vocabulary. It's not the most diverse language. The language with the most loan words. It's not the most syntactically complex or simple language. It's not the most irregular language or least phonetic language. It's not really any extreme of anything. Mm. It's just everything. I think English is incredible because it is in many ways without pretense. It doesn't have its own kind of designs in many ways to preserve Englishness. I think all of the efforts people have made to, like, gut English and strip it of its spirit and make it more French or more Latin or change it in some way, all it's done is make it adaptable. Improvise, adapt, overcome.
Yeah, like it doesn't, English doesn't get conquered. It just absorbs you. It's like the blob.
Yes.
It's like, it is so cute that you thought you could change me.
Exactly. And I think it's, you know, it's such a beautiful kind of turning of the tables that, you know, French used to be on its way to eclipse English completely. I mean, English was on its way out. French, you know, was totally infecting our language. And now, like, when French sees English knocking at the door, French is getting the baseball bat.
Oh, yeah,
French,
the National Academy is freaking out. It's like, no, do not say le texte. Say le communication électronique.
Yeah, I mean, you know, instead of video game, you're supposed to say, like, jeu de vidéo de électronique or something. You know, don't say computer, say ordinateur, l'ordinateur. Please.
L'ordinateur, I will say, at least has a kind of conciseness to it that je joue le game de computer is bullshit. Like,
yeah, but you know, guess what fucking language computer comes from? Le French.
Oh, it is all come full circle.
Also, like, video and game, I'm pretty sure both have romance origins. Like, they need to chill out.
Yeah. Hear that, National Council, National Academy? Chill out, man.
And that's my take on the podcast.
And that's the tooth.
All right.
Well, that's going to just about do us for another episode of the Weird Medieval Guys podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. This is a very unusual one, I think. We kind of took a different approach, a different focus than we usually do. Usually we're just like, hey, let's read way too much of this overly long text and do a silly voice.
Yeah, we did a couple silly... Well, you did silly voices.
Yeah.
I just...
You did a very silly William F. Buckley.
Yeah, I did.
Why?
I am a southern gentleman named William F. Buckley.
Yeah. I hope you enjoyed it. It was a bit of a departure for us. I think, you know, there's one of the things that I like about this show is that it can kind of be anything and we can take any kind of approach to history and come at it from any different direction, which is fantastic. And I, you know, a huge shout out to Olivia, who is just an absolute font of knowledge about etymologies and about linguistics. And she knows just a terrifying amount. I am shocked that I was able to contribute anything. She would have done this all without me if I'd said no. All right, well, if you like this episode and you like this podcast, please do leave us a 5-star review on your podcast platform of choice. And you can also leave us a Spotify comment. If you do, Olivia will read it out to you. Maybe.
Yes. Thank you to AAAA Mary, who says, I can only imagine how pissed I'd be to be a horse and get airlifted onto a ship with zero say in the matter. Absolute shit deal. You're right. I agree.
I don't think they really like being airborne horses.
It's horsophobia.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to canter off into the sunset.
I'm going to go fight a big dragon.
Excellent.
It's a Beowulf reference.
I'm going to go beat up the French.
Whoa! Take it easy.